This show is not for the easily offended. So if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
Welcome back, folks. It's Indie Comic Book Noise 419. And I have a pretty good news to tell you all. And that is we have a full house for the first time in far too long. And a full house means...
I thought you said this was going to be the last episode. I thought that's what the good news was.
And that voice was Phil the Ottawa Otter dialing in from
not
north
the
of
Ottawa
the
Otter, but yeah.
I have to get
joining him.
I have to give Phil a seat back.
And that is Super Steve coming in from the bunker on loan from Marvel Noise, where he's been busily overseeing the world engine. And last but not least, the regular of Indie Comic Book Noise, WWX Kevin from up north.
We only have the mammoth engine on this one.
So we're all back. Indie Comic Book Noise is the show where we talk about all things independently comic booky, including media tie-ins and things that have some tangential connection to the big two. We're part of the Deliberate Noise Network. You can find old episodes on the website, indiecomicbooknoise.com. Thanks to Derek Coward, who is the grand poobah of the Noise Network. You can check out his show, Comic Book Noise, and all the other fine shows, including Marvel Noise, which features some of these same voices, although Marvel Noise does not have the disclaimer at the beginning that you heard, because Marvel Noise doesn't have bad language. This show has some saucy language, but... generally, I don't think that
really
offensive.
No.
Well, now that Phil's back.
Well, no, I've been pretty good. Oh. I think Andrew swears more than me now.
I just have to do that so Kevin doesn't hide and use this stuff in Marvel Noise accidentally.
He swears a lot of Marvel Noise, too. I just edit it out.
Because Andrew's been very grumpy lately towards comics.
Have you noticed that? Surprise, Andrew. This is the intervention episode.
Put down the comics, Andy. Put down the comics. I'm excited to have all the crew back in. We are on the Twitters, Indie Comic Book N. We supposedly have a Facebook page. We all have individual Twitter accounts as well.
So and we also don't refer to Twitter as a hellscape, like some... like other people do. So, you know.
Yeah, some of us. Phil is
on the
least.
I think Twitter is evil as fuck.
But Kevin and I and Super Steve are on Twitter a fair amount. Kevin's on a lot, I think. Probably the most of us. Then I would say me and Super Steve rounding it out. But
which
there's lots of great
because
people.
Whenever someone starts a conversation of, hey, I saw this thing on Facebook, my brain automatically fills in, oh no, what are they going to tell me?
And
which is usually the reverse of what other people think.
People think that Twitter is going downhill, but it's going uphill because much talked about comic book artist Richard Sala just joined Twitter.
Yeah, that was cool.
Not that long ago, which is totally cool. Mm-hmm. Like, wow, we like him. Steve and I both have original artwork from him. So
maybe he'll post stuff.
Yeah, he has been. I've been following his account assiduously, and I recommend it for people that are fans. A lot of the comic book professionals maintain social media presences and seem to be fairly accessible, or at least the interns that run their account make them appear accessible. And that's all you can hope for, is the illusion of it, genuine interaction.
The Twitter sweatshop.
So, boys...
That book you gave me is by that Richard Salzenick. Steve, yes. Valencia, is that exactly. It? Yeah, I like that one a lot.
Yeah,
that
was cool. That was the first one of his I read as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, gentlemen. As tradition dictates, we normally go in a sort of round robin-y fashion. Who wants to throw out the first book?
Oh, man. All right, I'm going to make myself at home and say that I have been reading a book. I immediately thought of Kevin, actually, when I saw this book, because the creator is Matt Kinn.
Oh, yeah, because I remember the last time you covered Kint. It was, I'm like, oh, that's one of his lesser works. or, oh, that's one of the things I didn't enjoy as much. And then this time, I was just like, oh, no, now Steve's going to cover something I haven't read.
Yeah, well, I'm sure if you read it, you would consider it a lesser work, because it isn't one of his more popular ongoing in the Kint multiverse type of scenario here. This is a done in one, although I hope that there is more. And it's Matt Kint written, and art is by Brian Hurt. And then Matt Kint does the watercolor colors over Hurt's line work, which is kind of a cool way for him to throw his artistic touch and to give it a very unique look for people who like either artist, actually. It's an interesting combination here. And it is a done-in-one graphic novel that is slightly larger than digest size. And it's Poppy and the Lost Lagoon. On the cover, there are tentacles coming up from the bottom of the page. You know me, I love tentacles. And a girl wide-eyed flying towards the reader on a magic carpet with a elderly gentleman being pulled off the back of the magic carpet by the tentacles.
Steve, this isn't one of those Japanese tentacle comic books, is it?
It's
that
not.
We need to be worried about?
It's not. You know, I love me some old men in tentacles, but... Well, what drew me to this is my father has my kids call him Poppy instead of Grandpa. And it's because he really loves the old poop deck Pappy of Popeye fame, who is one of the best, you know, in the media grandfather type characters, I think. Poop deck Pappy is hilarious. But so I saw this Poppy in the Lost Lagoon. I saw the old man and the young girl, and I'm like, that's her grandfather. She calls him Poppy. She's going to go on adventures with him. Even though the gender doesn't match my kids, who are both boys, I thought we might get a kick out of reading this. And right on the first couple of pages, I was surprised that Poppy isn't the old fella, but Poppy is the girl. And the old man is her grandfather's partner. Her grandfather and this old fellow were adventurers together, and they went on many worldwide adventures in, you know, the early 50s and 40s time, when there was still a lot of globe to discover and uncover, you know, both in the wild and undersea, even in the air. And it seems like they went on some crazy adventures directed by a young Ramses, who is trapped by spell in a dwelling, but has a bunch of mystical artifacts, and he is immortal himself, and he's able to give these two adventurers bits and pieces of information to send them on their way. And he keeps a giant collection of all the cool stuff that they find. So these adventurers went on an adventure where they accidentally changed an ecosystem and then did their best to fix what they had done. The actual story beats are quite entertaining. I'm being aloof as to not spoil the good stuff, but the grandfather was lost, and he made the other fellow promise that he would take care of his granddaughter. So now this is years later. It's the old fellow and his old partner's granddaughter, Poppy, and they go on their adventures together. And she's smart as a whip. She's got the genetics of her grandpa, who was the great adventurer. She has a photographic memory. They have this amazing library of books with these fabulous titles that are so many words. You'd think you couldn't fit them all on a cover. And she remembers everything. So she, like any good scholar, rather than necessarily knowing a lot of stuff, she knows where to look stuff up and recalls, like, oh, yeah, that was in there. Let me just look. Oh, here it is. You know, that kind of thing. And so they go on a grand adventure that ends up being the fallout from the ecosystem destruction that her grandfather and her caretaker were responsible for all those years ago. And she ends up making it right when all is said and done, which is kind of cool. It's fun. It's all ages, but I don't think that reading a younger reader would be able to enjoy the intricacies of it. They would enjoy it, but it's really something that you could read to a kid, but it's definitely enjoyable for any age, meaning, you know, our age included. There's a fun whimsicalness to it. Kevin, it also made me think of you there's a Bandette quality to it too, because the young granddaughter is wide-eyed and so eager to just throw herself out there to fully experience whatever the world is going to offer up in these different opportunities that present themselves. And she's putting herself at incredible danger, at least as her caretaker sees it. But at the same time, she's never really in danger because that attitude, she's sort of dancing through the story like Bandette does.
Mm.
I found it really fun, and I hope there's more, not even to share with anyone else, but just selfishly to enjoy more of it myself, because the magical things that they find on the Earth. Like, I like the idea of an Earth that has, you know, like the hidden map of where all the magical things are, right? And that there's fun stuff to be uncovered under every rock. There could be some sort of secret and some sort of other society or anything. It's a book full of appreciation of a world of wonder. Poppy and the Lost Lagoon. I really, really dug it.
And is that Dark Horse again, Steve?
It is Dark Horse.
Yeah, I figured. Well, this podcast loves Matt Kent, so there was our weekly Matt Kent segment. This time brought to you by Steve instead of Kevin or myself.
Right.
Tell you, Matt Kent better cut us a check for all this positive coverage we're firing his way. That sounds pretty good for one of his lesser works.
When everyone says Dark Horse now, I think of a recent announcement that Jimbo is going to IDW, and I was like, what? That's like one of the things I identify Dark Horse with.
Yeah.
Jimbo? What do you mean?
Usagi Yojimbo by Stan Sakai.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow.
And then losing the Conan license, too, and Star Wars not too long ago.
That's right.
Dark Horse is turning into Hellboy comics.
Yeah.
Well, what about Black Hammer?
Oh, yeah.
That's true.
Wait, stop.
Ding!
I'm out.
All right. There's lots of good Black Hammer stuff out right now.
We can't do Matt Kent and Black Hammer in the same episode. There are limits to what... Otherwise, we might as well just release an old episode and call it a new one. But I want to get in early on this. Kevin is holding our mini-episode ransom currently, but if he releases it, we discuss the recent Long Beach Comic Expo I went to, and I mentioned I bought a few books, but I didn't actually give them their proper due.
I wonder why. Oh, people can listen back.
So I ended up really enjoying one of the books. Well, I enjoy both of the indie books I got, but I wanted to spotlight one of them from M&S Comics. It's a miniseries, and it's Out of Order number 1, and it's a husband and wife team. And I really got a big kick out of this. It's Sol Young Lee wrote an art by Mike Ahn. And it's black and white, and for me, it really brought me back to the black and white boom of the early 80s. And one of the beautiful things about comics, especially that time, was it really had a low barrier to entry. So a lot of people did a lot of really great kind of personal stories, because even if you were going to do a movie or even, you know, a TV show or play or whatever, it takes so much money and people and talent. And I think what was awesome about comics is, especially then, and even now to some degree, it doesn't take a lot. You just need to put the pen to the paper and come out with the book. And it's a love story between two characters, and the one character has schizophrenia. And then you read in the back that it's based on their own marriage. And the husband, they've been married for 9, and they said it's like, they had a great moment in the afterword about how, look, like, some of these things are true and some are made up, but the spirit of the story is the truth.
Well, that goes with the schizophrenia, right?
Yeah.
Some of these things are made up. Some the voices told me, some...
So it's interesting to see, and this might have resonated because a friend of the family has schizophrenia. So, and it usually, the ones I'm familiar with, much like this character, kind of sets in late teens, early 20s. And the same thing happens with the protagonist of this book. And I also guess the artist of the book, who it's somewhat based on. And I just really like the kind of black and white, simple line art, the sort of lettering that's very personal. And in the, so sometimes the balloon size has extra space and sometimes it doesn't, and it just has a very indie design feel that I really like and fits the storyline. And it does something that people say I don't like, because I usually don't, and that is it's told all out of order. But I think given the nature of this character's illness and how it comes and goes, and there are good days and bad days and episodes and not episodes and medication and not medication and all these different things, I think it seems particularly appropriate and pushes you kind of all over the place, which I'm sure is meant to help you empathize with the character's condition.
Yeah, the story has to be fractured, told in a fractured way.
And they only have one big section of him having a particular outburst. So I like that it wasn't sensationalized. And in the afterwards, they go to stress, like, the illness isn't his identity. It's an element. It's, you know, part of who he is, but it's not all of who he is. I don't know. I just really, they had 3. I only picked up the first issue. They want to go 5 issues, and I'm definitely going to pick up more when I see it. Because I assume they must be local. There were references to local areas here. But Mike and Soul, SEOL Comics at big.bigcartel.com. If you want to pick these up, I'll put a link, or at least the description in the show notes. Yeah, and it was just one of those nice throwback, a very personal kind of small comic story. And I'm like, I'm really excited. This is what I walk around Artist Alley sometimes to find, these sort of books where people are telling their story the way they want to do it, and in a way that just resonated with me. Maybe I'll try and send you guys some images or whatever of the book. But yeah, all in all, huge thumbs up. Like I said, when I see them, I'll buy whatever new issues they have of it.
Or trade them Prozac.
I don't know that. I didn't think it was Prozac. I thought they took other. I thought Prozac was for depression.
No, it is. That's more of a mood disorder thing. Yep.
Yeah. Anyways, cool. Very cool story. Very cool comic book. That's me trying to put it back in the bag, so I'll stop. Because when I'm editing, I'm like, what are all those annoying noises? And I'm like, oh, that's me futzing around with the comic book.
<Yeah. laughs> I was wondering, is someone opening a bag of chips?
No, it's me opening up the bags of the comic books. I think it adds a verisimilitude when I'm doing it. When I'm listening to it, I'm like, what are you doing, you moron? So anyways,
wait, you bag your comics?
Most of the ones I buy come in bags and boards. Oh,
okay.
Especially when you're in India. Well, they don't always come with boards. The other one I bought, which I'll discuss later, just came with the bag and not the board. But I think most people sell them with a bag or board. That's how you pick them up. But generally speaking, no. Maybe about a third of my comics are bagged and board, and there is no real rhyme or reason to it.
You know what? When I'm picking up, like, different indie comics, I don't think they usually, like, that usually never happens.
Yeah, but
like maybe at a regular con, but like TCAF, no one has bags and boards.
Yeah, but for you, indie is either like something that they drew on a napkin for $47 yeah, a piece, or it's Image Comics. So neither one of those are going to come bagged and board. I'm talking regular size, floppy. They're releasing this comic not as some art project, but as their thing.
Bags and boards be damned.
Well, Phil, we haven't heard from you in a while. Have you been reading any indie comics? Any horror books?
Well, recently I've read Tales of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles from Mirage, the first one. You know, I think IDW did one too. Have you ever read those ones?
Depends which ones.
I think it's 8 issues, and the first issue is basically they take place in between other issues. Like they'll say this takes place before then or whatever. And I don't know why, but I always like the classic Turtle Tales. I just find there's character development's no good or anything like that. What makes me really mad though is it's so hard to tell who's who.
This is true.
They'll never have the weapons on.
Yeah.
They all look the exact same. So it's like, it's, that can be a bit of a pain in the butt. But yeah, the first issue of this one, it's, it takes place at, is it Casey Jones?
Yes. He's the guy with the hockey mask.
Yeah. He, at his, cottage place there, you know, it was in the first movie too, where they hide out for a bit, and it's just him and his cousin comes with a gang and they kind of try and rough them up a bit, like just dumb little stories like that. But two that stood out to me, one unfortunately I don't have but I wish I did, the first one was the first appearance of the Rat King. Which is, at least I think it's his first appearance. He wasn't called the Rat King yet, and he didn't really get rats until the end, but didn't really use them for anything, so I think they were just figuring out his character, maybe, at the time. And the issue I'm missing, which sucks, the one I want the most, is the first appearance of Leatherhead, the alligator character.
Yeah.
And I don't know what issue 8 is, but I have 1-6.
Wow.
Oh boy. I've never read or seen a full Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle comic or show or movie,
really?
Or anything. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Are you serious?
Yeah. What I mean, you know, I've seen, you know, flipped through and seen like that it was on, but never. It all happened right when I was getting out of comics, and mm-hmm. It was past my radar, and I was moving on at the time, so I never looked back. No.
But it's even the movies? That's crazy.
Yeah, no.
I only had a few of the books because they were pretty expensive pretty quickly. Like, to fill in back issues.
They had something like 9 printings or something, so.
Yeah, but you have to remember I lived in a place that had limited access to books, so it was like the one comic book shop and whatever issues he got from week to week or month to month. The distribution wasn't too solid. My favorite one that I did pick up was Donatello had one about how to use a bow staff. It was like a martial arts book. Mm-hmm. It was an instruction, and he would show you all the positions to do your own little kata with it and everything. And it made me laugh, and so I bought that one. But I kind of missed the... By the time the wagon came on, those issues. And look, back then to me, I don't remember what they were, but like a $20 would have been a lot for a comic. I wouldn't have paid $20 for a comic book back then. So even if I don't remember what they were running for, but even that little amount would have been Andy no buying it. So mm-hmm. I had to save my money for cheap. Like, it was rare. Even the beginning of those graphic novels was always a hard decision to spend the $5 or $6 or whatever it was. For even though it was a big comic, you're like, I don't know, that's a lot of money, man. Now that's a floppy.
Wow.
Oh my god. My one remaining childhood friend, I met him, he was working at the comic book store, but it was funny because when we got to know each other, he was like, yeah, we used to hate you because you would come in with like 75 cents and spend so much time in the nickel comic box, like carefully going through to cull out your favorite, you know, however little money you had. I would spend all that time just going obsessively through the junk comics to see how many of the cheapest comics I could put together to get out with my pittance.
I've been reading some of the Turtles, and I think it's Turtles in Time.
Okay, yeah, I read some of that.
Yeah.
There was a lot of those minis though, so it depends which one.
The IDW, where they're like, they're in the past.
They run in with that future lady or whatever.
Yeah. And eventually they end up in the future, and it's like Shredder Island instead of New York. Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of minis I want to check out, like the Shredder in Hell, I think is a recent one.
I wonder if he's going to run into Godzilla.
Or Nancy.
I like Nancy in Hell, yeah.
Nancy versus Godzilla versus the Shredder in Hell. I think I got a book that Andrew has.
Is it Oberon?
No, it Oberon. Isn't.
That sounds familiar.
It's an Aftershock.
I read that. Yeah. Oh,
I thought it was a Gargoyles character.
That's why I figured Kevin wouldn't have it. So what book is it then, Kevin?
Criminal.
Yes, I actually bought the first two issues of that.
There we almost go. I only have the first issue.
I almost got that, but I feel like I've read so much Criminal, I can't do it anymore.
Criminal is back, though.
And set in the world of comic book people.
What do you mean?
Well, as you say, it is Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips, so you are getting that.
I thought it was set in the world of wrestling from the issue I read.
Well, you need to get to issue 2.
Does it get weird?
Well, issue 2 is set in 87, and it has to do with an old-timey comic book artist going to a convention. And the crime is being set up there. What's interesting is they decided to use all real name references other than this guy and the characters. So it's like, you know, when he left, he punched Julie Schwartz in the face and got in a fight with Jerry Conway. And, you know, so it's interesting when they weave in the real people into the book, which I assume the main protagonist artist guy is portrayed as a jerk. But none of the real comic book people referenced are. Yeah. They're just made it to look like it was a real thing, you know.
I mean, if it makes sense, because if it's taking place in the same world and the people are, you know, available at that time for.
I don't know how I feel if they should have just went all fake or if it helps or hurts having like, oh, Stan Lee will be at the dinner or whatever.
Yeah.
Or if you just feel like, but this guy didn't exist, so. I don't know. My mental jury is out. Because the other problem is you start trying to figure out who this guy is, if this guy is supposed to be someone.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's why they put it in the real world, so that someone would be like, no, this wasn't meant to be like a thinly disguised version of, you know, Wally Wood or Jack Kirby or whatever.
As long as they don't have like 5-year-old Ed Brubaker walking up to Julie Schwartz and some weird thing.
I don't know. Well, anyways, tell us about issue 1, Kevin.
Tell you about issue 1. As he gets the comic together, right? it's not the smooth Steve, what did you call that? Production level.
No, I had to make a phone call. But I did. Have you guys read Burnouts from Image?
Which one is that?
That,
give me a brief.
There's 5 issues in. It's written by Dennis Culver with art by Jeffo. And Jeffo, I recognize his name from storyboarding the first wave of the Marvel digital comics, not the motion ones, but when they started doing their own, like the layouts would either be done by, you know, when they were doing like the swiping page, like all the layers kind of stuff, it would either be by Jeffo or Riley Brown. And so he did a bunch of those, and now Marvel's digital stuff is very different. And here he is doing another comic here. And the idea of this comic is like a teenage high school metaphor for a straight kid starting to expand his consciousness in high school and starting to do drugs and do things that aren't necessarily on the straight and narrow and with the program and part of the just being a cog in the machine, you know, and starting to kind of do your own thing. He falls in with a fast crowd at a party. But the catch is when you are high, So the kids are smoking marijuana a lot in this book. But when you're high, you can see that there are these aliens that are invading. And aliens are floating around, and they are physically taking over people and possessing them. And then they have like a green glow behind their like eyes and kind of coming out of their nostrils and their mouth. And when you're high, you can see them. And then when you straighten up, you can't anymore. So he has this epiphany when he gets high for the first time, like, whoa, what's going on here? And the other guys that he came across who were the burnouts, who he previously snubbed and thought of as, you know, real outsiders, now realizes that they have a purpose here. They can see what everyone else can't, and they're on the case. And what they realize is that if you agitate the possessed being, you can get the alien to come out of his orifices, and then you can hit it with a baseball bat and pop it like a balloon.
Mm-hmm.
And so they even do things like cow tipping, but the cows that they're tipping are possessed cows. Like, that's one of the places the aliens can kind of find safe harbor, is in cattle. And so they have a whole adventure of that, and being run up a tree by the cows and all that sort of business. But the kiddo goes home, and not only does he have the thing of like his parents harshing his buzz because he's, you know, he's the straight and narrow kid who's obviously, you know, been getting into contraband for the first time, and they're worried about that, but his parents have the glow, so they're possessed. And then he's like, oh man, is this just a function of the drugs? Is this a real thing that I have to be worried about my parents? But like the next day, his parents seem like just like his regular old parents, or is that all part of the ruse? It's very clever. I honestly wish that the art was a little tighter or more intricate, but the storytelling is solid and you pretty much know what's going on. They have run-ins with the law, and some of the law is possessed and some of the law isn't. So like, there's a whole, who can you trust? Who can't you? It's been fun. I've been enjoying fun indie comics lately. Mm-hmm. You just sort of get on board and go along for the ride, and it's not something too much to wrap your head around, but just, you know, takes you away.
Yeah, that one caught my eye. I've only flipped through the first issue so far though.
There's five of them out, so it's I would almost think that it would be going wherever it's going sooner, but I don't think it's a limited series, so I guess they got time to do their thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my other book that I picked up from the indie rack was Five from Beyond, 48 pages of pulse-pounding terror. What drew me, for those of you wondering how you can sell books, is what drew me to this person's table was they had a lot of really nice pinups of their own stuff along with recognizable pop culture stuff, superheroes and space people and Indiana Jones and all that. And I really liked the art, and he also had his comic there. And what's interesting about the comic is not only is it an anthology, but while he worked on every story, he didn't draw them all. Some he wrote, some he drew, some he penciled, some he inked. So it's kind of a nice mishmash of his work. The other thing I thought was really interesting that I hadn't seen in a long time, and I don't know that I've seen it ever in an indie, is the middle spread is a pinup. Not related to any of the story. It's a jungle pinup of this tiger, fierce-looking tiger standing over a woman. And she has her eyes closed, and he's just roaring out into the jungle. And I was just, like I said, the guy's artwork drew me in. So that's what caused me to buy. And it's an anthology book, so it's your typical mishmash of, obviously, Five from Beyond, five stories. The other thing I thought that was interesting was the last story is Continued. It says Continued in Electric Youth. I don't know what that is, but what's funny is Kyle Roberts is who I purchased the book from. It was his art table. He and someone else worked on the story, and someone else did the art for that one. So it has a much cleaner line. But I like his fidgety little details he puts in very lush color work. And I was almost tempted to purchase some of his artwork straight alone, but I'm kind of fading on that in general. I mean, I do buy some OA pages, and that's been my current focus. A few commissions here or there, but I'm getting away from the other type of stuff. But I just really, his artwork drew me in, and that caused me to buy his book, and it was fun to see different art takes, him connected to every story, but different ones. And again, with these small anthologies, most of them are sci-fi, and they have the twist ending. I'm not going to tell too much, because by the time you set these up, like, you've kind of told the entire story in a way. But it was really, I really liked it. I would buy, if he has, I see him in another short and he has another one, I may, or if it's early in the show, I might commission him to do some work for me. I don't know. Anyways, I really was impressed with his table and his artwork, and I don't remember what the issue cost, but Kyle Roberts was selling these 48 pages. That's a big comic. That's like, heck, that's more than twice of a regular Big Two comic at this point, right? Aren't they down to 19 or 20 pages?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow, 19.
I mean, I don't count them out, but I remember people complaining on the interwebs about how they're grinding down the page count on the stories and Big Two floppies.
I don't know if I would trust those people on the interwebs, though.
Well, I've got you with your stopwatch.
Especially those people at Twitter.com from the bad website. I don't know if...
You've got your stopwatch and your price guide tests.
So. I know. You know those Bronze Age comics, 17 pages and 40 minutes to read.
Whew. Yeah, but they got a good value on the price guide, right, Kevin? That makes up for it.
I don't know. It depends which ones you're buying. If you're buying some of those Uncanny X-Men, you know... Well, some of those are actually sometimes undervalued still. But anyhow, yeah, not bad on the price guide. Not the Captain Canuck, though. Not so good on the price guide.
I love those Don Newton covers on all those different price guides. He always did awesome covers for them. He must have done, what, 6 or 7 that I can recall. I miss Don Newton. I used to like getting those Overstreet price guides. Flipping through.
Still, never bought one.
They still come out with them, Steve.
Yeah,
San Diego. Well, I think they always have their fancy cover version. They always have like alternate covers on the place. You know,
because when we were kids, there was no internet to give you that connection to the rest of fandom. You know, it was one of the reasons why I really liked Fred Hembeck's strips so much, because it was like, here's a guy who's a fan and he's like talking about all other fan type stuff in his editorial cartoons and in the buyer's guide at the time. And it was those different ways of being able to connect with the greater, you know, the club that you were on the inside of was fun. And those price guides, the first, you know, quarter of them where they would have all, you know, some of the color pages and some of the articles and stuff like that. That stuff was cool. I dug all that.
Oh, I loved flipping through them and looking at random, just wondering what, and the kind of grading, and they had the little chart with the prices and everything. It was fun. I was right there with you. It's not like I still don't use prominent. Now I use prominent comic book resellers as like a rough price guide, eBay and a few other shop or whatever. But yeah, it was fun to just flip through at random because there were so many titles. I'm not a big Silver Age or the Big Little Books or all that other stuff that was in there. You'd look at all that weird stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, back then it was like the ads were fun. Like the ads were interesting because they showed you other stuff that was out there. Yeah, that you may have not known about, or just other collections of stuff, or I even with the comics, those pages that would have like the 25 or 30 little small ads, almost like the classified page of ads that would be in the comics. I used to love to pour through those and see all that crazy stuff. Send $2 to Bob for the X-ray glasses or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I also loved in Mile High, I used to do those double page spreads where they'd list like the buy, you know, hot comics and their prices and what you could buy off them.
It kills me to look at those now and see the prices, how low they were. But at the time, those were inflated, right? Because it's Mile High. So it's like, oh, man, those were the inflated prices?
Yeah. If Andy goes back in time, he will not be buying the entire New Universe run. Instead, he'll be buying every Silver Age Spider-Man he can get his hands on.
Ding!
But we didn't know any better. We were having fun. Like I said, back then, at least for me, $20 was a fortune. So
I remember seeing, I don't know which printing it was, but like Turtles number one, whatever printing, like $12. And I'm like, $12? And I'm like, no way I could afford that.
I have that that one that starts with G. Isn't that their first appearance? Gizmoid or whatever. Yeah, a friend gave me that, so I think he didn't know that it was important.
Well, it's hard to...
Phil will like it. Phil will like anything.
Yeah.
Here's something unimportant. Here's a lesser work by Matt Kint.
It's wow. One of those oversized, annoying ones that you can't store anywhere.
I know some retailers hate those oversized comics.
Yeah, I don't like them.
I'm of a mixed bag, too. Sometimes they're worth it, but sometimes you are looking at, like, this ain't fitting in the short box, and I can't seem to get it in anything else. But, what are you going to do?
Try a magazine box on its side.
Well, I did buy a couple of short boxes for graded comics.
Wow, you bought graded boxes?
Well, I have a ridiculous amount of... For a guy that has little interest in graded comics, I have more than you would think.
Wow.
But, yeah, I have more comics. If you people don't talk, you'll be subjected to more comics. Well, I was going to ask you something,
Andrew. Did we talk about Jacob Phillips?
I don't think so, did we?
The Colors for Criminal?
No.
His son? I just thought that's weird that Criminal's been around so long. His son is now coloring the comic.
That's funny.
Because I was partway into this, and I'm like, wait a second, the coloring's different. I look back, I'm like, huh, how about that?
Does he stay inside the lines? Does he stay inside those lines?
I didn't know it was his kid, so.
Yeah, isn't that weird?
It's a pretty common last name, Phillips. I'm like,
yeah. But I guess I was used to, I guess it was Val Staples, and then I think maybe David Stewart did some Criminal. So it's weird that it's in the family now, and I'm like, I keep on thinking back to our Bitterroot thing where, well, they threw some color on that scene that's not the color of everything in there.
Well, look, I'm sure he doesn't have to pay his kid the full rate, so, you know, you're saving money here and there.
Wow. Know?
What's
the
kid going to do? So, well?
This all worked out so well for Matt Wagner.
Yeah, I wonder what that must be an arrangement, right? Oh, but I mean, it looks fine. I could tell like partway in because it wasn't the traditional Criminal coloring. Like, there's a lot of stuff in here that's I think very traditional Criminal, where there's a lot of Criminal stuff going on, and then you see Leo, and I'm like, oh, I remember that guy from like the first. It's his younger self, but from the first Criminal story. And then, like, there's the undertow. And, like, all this stuff seems familiar. And I'm, like, getting back into that groove. And I'm like, this is good. I like this. And then the coloring, I'm like, wait a second here.
It is funny. Does Brubaker's niece do the lettering or something?
And then they have that whole thing in the back about... We might have got, like, new readers and everything, but that their first thing was, like, Kill or Be Killed. Because they've been collaborating for so long, and then they have all the... It's not just, like, ads for the other volumes. It's, like, his personal, like, he's personally describing, like, what each volume is like. So I was sort of going through, going, yeah, that was good. That was great. That was the worst one. So I think The Sinners is probably the worst... The lower tier Criminal story. The lesser work.
Yeah, I'm bad about that back matter stuff. For some reason, a lot of times, there's no pictures or not enough. Text.
You just look at the pictures when they have an illustration of some movie they're talking about, and you're like, that's cool, and then you're done.
Exactly. I failed the stopwatch test. Yeah,
when it's insights from the creator, that's cool. Like Kirkman does with the Invincible in the back, in the trades, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
Yeah, what's good is when, like, you're writing like whatever you're writing about, but if you're writing like criminal and then you're like giving recommendations on like other TV series or movies or something, I'm like, that's worthwhile. But for the best criminal stories, I was thinking the first one, Coward, mm-hmm. Bad Night.
Yeah, I like that one.
And of course, The Last of the Innocent, which is the Archie one.
Yeah, that's my favorite one. That's great.
And he's like, yeah, everyone seems to like this one.
I forgot about that one.
They did the Dark Archie before Archie Comics did, right? I mean, that's the whole, everyone's like, oh man, Archie Comics is so genius for doing these more mature stories with the characters and the dark stories and the horror stories. And oh, now it's a hit TV show trying to do that type of take. And Criminal mm-hmm. did it first.
Yeah, I mean, it's more than Archie. Like, there's a little bit of like Richie Rich and Encyclopedia Brown, but it's really messed up, that story. Which is weird, because The Sinners comes just before that, and that's the one where you're like, I don't know. Like, it's still enjoyable, but you're like, I don't know, maybe the series has run its course. And then, what does he say? Yeah, his father dies, and then he writes the weird, like, weird Archie bizarro stuff, and I'm like, I don't know. I don't know, man. Like, that's a weird place to go, but it works. Oh, you want me to do an update too, Andrew?
It's up to you. I saw it. You said you were still reading Die, and I've been reading that too.
Yeah, I read the second issue.
Is that the Robert Kirkman one?
No.
Oh.
That's Die, Die, Die.
This Die. That's right.
Dylan and Stephanie Hahn.
Somebody died.
D&D one.
Wait, is that Dan Parent's Die Kitty Die?
Shoot, I would have picked that one up if I saw
it. And I just read issue 3. So what do you think of issue 2, Kevin?
I had less of an issue with this one.
Yeah, didn't it really pick up quite a bit? And I felt like maybe starting with issue 2, I don't feel like you'd be missing anything really.
Yeah, I don't know, the first issue just got into so much details about their world, and I was just like, you know, you're like, okay, like that was a massive info dump.
Yeah, and not only that, but by issue 3, like, I don't think any of that stuff is it. Because they're so in the world, like, and it's a story. I'm sure at some point those individual factors will get pieced in. But by then, I'll have long forgotten, like, which one is getting divorced and which one.
Yeah.
Because one was getting, like, there was a bunch of drama happening in all their different lives. But, yeah, and once they get to the fantastical world, I feel like it's a more appropriate setting for this creature. Although, and again, in 3, they also have that front page where they say who everyone is. Isn't that handy?
It is handy. And I also like the coloring better on this one with the reds instead of the yellows. But what's funny about this is they have the whole caption box narration thing. And some of this feels like you're reading like some kind of D&D manual or looking at some Magic the Gathering cards. Like, I definitely get that flavor text, pictures, you know, cards type of thing.
Yes.
I didn't do a whole lot of board gaming.
I agree with you. They're not hiding any of that from us at the front end. And 3, like I said, you're even more into the world, and it just sort of pushes you forward into the middle of some weird campaign. It doesn't feel as connected to 2, but if you like this world they're in, then I assume that's where they're going to spend most of their time as opposed to the real world. The premise for this, for those of you that don't know, is, to quote the little caption box, in 1991, 6 teenagers disappeared into a fantasy role-playing game, 5 returned. Then 2018, which is, you know, over 25 years later, the 5 are dragged back to find that the one guy that remained still wants to play the game. So in this fantasy realm, they all have superpowers and they have alternative identities. Yeah, exactly. The first issue went to great pains to kind of lay that out and was, I felt, needlessly complicated about their current life and had all these flashbacks of the different times. But 2, they just sum over
the premise, though.
Yeah.
I really like that premise, yeah.
But it seems like they went through pain great pains to describe that at where you got it in 1 second. It's Jumanji.
Mm-hmm.
Goth Jumanji.
Well, it's also a little bit of mixed genres, which I like.
Yeah.
You know, so you might sign canons or weird multi-tech, because more of the role, especially, certainly by 91, the role-playing games were definitely mixing and bending genres quite a bit and having different elements and different ones, which I like. That was right about as I was getting out. I was out of role-playing at that time, but I think at college I tried a ill-fated Shadowrun attempt. Well, Phil, did you read Oberon? I have that here and can talk about it. That was after Shark Book.
I can't remember what it's about, but I feel like, is it the one where it's the woman and she has to go to this world?
Yes, it's based on...
It's all messed up.
It's based on the, you know, Oberon from Shakespeare, I believe, and it's Ryan Parrott and Milos Slavkovic. And basically, she is like the link to the fairy world. And she's homeschooled with her parents. And the starts with the frog knight defending the light.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I had kind of a vaguely Fables-esque feel, although not Mark Buckingham. And it's no offense to Milos.
I liked it, the art.
I thought the art was good. But I think Mark Buckingham.
I
didn't read
it yet, but I love these type of comics. And but yeah, when I flipped through it, it looked like it would be something I would enjoy.
But basically, she gets tricked into going into the fairy world, and it turns out that she thinks she was a normal girl raising up, but her parents weren't really her parents. They were trying to protect her from Oberon, king of the fairies. And, you know, whenever you fairies in traditional literature are actually very dangerous to deal with. They're like dealing with genie or whatever. Their tricks and wishes never go quite the right way. And part of it is trying to get ahead of them and outsmart them.
You sound like you have personal experience with fairies.
Yeah, I like the old timey, where they really are very menacing.
Yeah, they're like a lot of those makers.
Brownies and sprites. Yeah, they're not nice. Like, they do great harm to people. And what was interesting is in the issue I have, they do a 3-page spotlight on the Stronghold comic, which I also picked up. Thought it was weird that they had it in the back of that one, but in the back of Stronghold, they do not have a feature of any other comic.
Devil's Due comic, Stronghold?
No, the Aftershock comic, Stronghold by Phil Hester.
Is that the same
Kelly?
Series?
In this instance, it might be. I don't know the premise of that one. In this one, the idea is there's this character with superpowers who doesn't know his identity, and there's a support network who conceals his identity of him being this savior of the world. But the problem is, if he realizes his power, it will advance the apocalypse. So someone from the hidden support group that tries to keep him in the dark confronts him with this and pushes him into a situation where he has to use his powers. And that could very well end up bringing the end of the world. It's a very interesting premise I enjoyed. Mm-hmm. I like Ryan Kelly's artwork. I follow him on Twitter. I like Phil Hester's writing. The twist at the end really got me with how they set up the alliances. I do feel it's a little overwritten in a way. Like, they could have probably cut... it feels like they just lay all this stuff out. And I feel like we could probably have gotten... we didn't need it so much explained to us. I don't know. Maybe Aftershock is reaching a lot of brand new comic book people. But I feel like with some of these series, they really kind of hold your hand a lot more. And I'm like, you know, most of us have read a lot of effing comics. And so we're familiar with the Jumanji concept and this concept of like the secret organization that monitors behind. Like, all these things are... none of these are new tropes that we've never seen before. At least I feel. I don't know if you boys notice some of these number ones being maybe more explainy than they need to be, or that might just be me.
So I failed the stopwatch test because it was too long.
I was just like, so it's a lot of this guy, he's an insurance exec, and so it just goes into kind of a lot of his viewpoint and all this stuff when he first gets introduced. And I felt like you could probably just have eliminated every third caption box and probably gotten us to the same point. And a lot of it, but I don't know. I'm also might be in the mood where I'm more for the pictures doing the lifting over the story. But like I said, I had a great hook at the end of issue one that was set up well. And I'm like, I like it. And maybe now that we have the premise, much like Die issue two or whatever, I feel once the premise is done, it might speed things up. You know, you're thrown into it. We don't need to explain nothing. Go, 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 go.
Not just that, but once the hook is enough that it interests you, then it makes you possibly want to go back and read the things that you might have skimmed over because you were kind of just waltzing through it to see if it was going to capture you. You know what I mean? That happens with me a lot. I'll kind of skim through. You said you probably could have done one out of every three caption boxes. I might only read one out of every three caption boxes as I'm skimming through to see if there's something that grabs me enough to make me care enough to, you know, it's like when we started reading comics as youths, we jumped into series not at number one often, although, you know, Kevin was there for Darkhawk number one and all those, that good wave of Sleepwalker number one and all that.
Miguel!
But, you know, we jumped into comics in the hundreds and other times, and if there was something that caught us, we decided, all right, it was worth going back and trying to find a reprint or a back issue or what happened. And I get some of that with the, you know, I've talked before about how it's hard to introduce new concepts to a jaded old curmudgeon like myself. So when something does capture me, I give it a chance, and if there's something meets threshold and it's like, oh, okay, now I'm interested, I might go back and give it a solider read.
I think that's the Steve version of the stopwatch test. I don't know what to call that. The skim test. I don't know.
Well, to contrast it, at the show, I picked up from your man, Ron Mars, the first two issues of Turok. In fact, he announced that.
Well, I read that.
He broke Street Date with Turok by a few days, number two. Castro does great art, and I felt that was, like you said, Steve, drops you right in, gives you a couple characters, doesn't seem to have a lot of unnecessary info dumping. I mean, again, it's a fairly straightforward concept, but I felt they handled it well, and like I said, I was really, this Castro guy, I like it. Andy likes the artwork.
It's a very,
very Joe Kubert-y kind of feel to it.
Yes. And it's a very straightforward concept that someone could easily overproduce and make into a conflagration of confusion and discombobulation. I mean, he keeps it simple. It doesn't have to be like he joked to me when they asked him what his pitch was for the book. It's like he's a dinosaur hunter, you know? Keep it simple. It doesn't. That's cool, you know? It doesn't have to have some sort of big complex web thrown over the top of it. Keep it to a few characters, put them in a cool situation, and go. Yeah, I'm enjoying that. I just read the second issue, and it's gotten better in the storytelling angle of it. There's more story happening as far as the interpersonal play between the characters, which is great.
Just waiting for Magnus Robot Humper to show up, Steve. We'll be all together.
With Hater. Remember that robot? He had the 8 instead of the A? Oh, he was awesome. That was in the Dynamite version, though, with Fred Van Lente.
I read a Boom book. 3 issues of a 5-issue limited series written by Sean Simon, art by Connor Nolan, and it's called Wizard Beach.
Awesome covers on that one.
That's what drew me in. The covers look fun. And like I said, I'm looking for some big dumb fun in my indie comics of late. This is a story of a young magician type. He's in a family of wizards. His dad seems like he's one of the head wizards in the land, and they're at a long war that they've slowly been losing by attrition. It's just been long and hard, and they're being beaten by the cold. I don't know if it's the cold magics or the ice queen or some type of cold is overtaking the land, and it's a sign of them losing the battle. the son references his uncle, his father's brother, who was the most powerful of them all, but who left and took a bunch of wizards with him on a mass exodus years ago, and like is never spoken of or allowed to be spoken of by the father wizard. And the son's like, well, we got to go get Uncle whatever, Uncle Wizard there, and get him to help, and he'll have the answer and the power, and he can help us turn the tide of this battle. And the dad's like, no, I forbid you. This is not happening. We're not speaking to him. He's dead to me, you know, that kind of thing. And so the son takes off in a adolescent act of rebellion. And he's going to go off and find his uncle and learn the magic that he needs to learn and come back and save the land. Well, I've read the first three issues of this 5-issue limited series, and he hasn't learned any new magic yet. So I don't know how this is all going to get resolved, which has me intrigued. But where he goes is to find his uncle, and his uncle is on the beach, Wizard Beach. You see, the wizards on this exodus, they became known to civilized lands. It's like once you walk through the forest, instead of being in this enchanted old literary type land of wizards and magic and demons and stuff, you're in our regular civilized world. And when he walks upon the beach where his uncle is, like in my head, I heard like Gary Newman's I Love L.A., you know, there's everything's going on around him. There's boardwalks, there's people on rollerblades, there's people surfing, there's sunbathing, there's food of every type, there's carnival games, there's people living life to the fullest, beach life, that is. And his uncle is the head of it all, and he is sitting there sunning himself, growing a nice big long beard, and is happy to see his nephew who he hasn't seen in so long. But he's either being purposefully aloof in his kind of intricate kind of way, or esoteric kind of way, or he is a little insane maybe, but he doesn't really give much attention to the concerns of his nephew. Instead, he kind of brings it upon himself that he's going to help the nephew to be more than what the life he was living had to offer, and show him cool stuff like surfing, like picnicking on the beach, like doing all the fun stuff that you can do, and realizing that, you know, I mean, it's almost a metaphor for like all these big problems in the world and everything like that, and don't let it really affect you on a day-to-day basis. Like, does what's going on in the the federal or national government really affect your ability to enjoy a day? Not really, even though eventually it may catch up to you, that kind of thing, and you want to be part of the movement that makes things right again and, you know, brings balance to the force and all that stuff. But he's trying to appeal to this uncle to teach him some magic to help him save his kingdom, and meanwhile his uncle wants to eat burritos and surf and stuff. It is fun. Along the way too, the adolescent has met or keeps crossing paths with a girl his age who now he's becoming interested in, and he's slowly learning about how the wizards became known to the civilized world and were almost forced to the beach, or like promised that they would stay on this beach community to keep the magic there, because people were kind of concerned about this whole wizarddom and all that business. It's a fun idea, and the art is really cool. That's what's really hooking me in. The uncle with his big beard.
Yeah,
and he hides
art's
behind.
Awesome.
Tom and Jerry's my favorite cartoon of, like, the old cartoons, you know, even with all its insensitivities and stuff. But the uncle wizard reminds me of Jerry Mouse's Uncle Mouse, who wears the cowboy hat, who comes and he's playing the ukulele, and whenever he breaks a string, he's got to pull one of Tom's whiskers out to restring his guitar, and he's just a tough little son of a gun, but the way he talks behind his big handlebar mustache and everything, there's some really good caricatures and faces and body types being portrayed here on the page. So far, it's a real fun book. That's my word of the night, fun.
Nothing wrong with fun. And nothing wrong with burritos, Steve. Nothing at all wrong with burritos. Although, they've probably led me down a path of non-healthfulness, but still, I love burritos.
But even like Tolkien, in his works, there was a giant scope of an adventure at play, but sometimes you just got to worry about what's for lunch, you know?
Oh, for sure. They like to...
Or second smoke breakfast.
They like to smoke all the weed. Talk about the finest weed in the South farthing.
With Tom Bombadil.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have a ring and you wait 10 years to get your quest going. It just happens.
Let me tell you, they got some mushrooms in Middle Earth that'll get you singing, that's for sure. Steve, was fishing in your neck of the woods from your boys at Ominous Press. I got The Art of Jim Starlin, Black Book.
Oh, cool. I did too.
I did the Kickstarter for it. Picked it up. It's an oversized hardcover, not giant size, but oversized. So it's nice. It's a interesting retrospective, including some of the Marvel and DC work. What I found most interesting about it, actually, it doesn't have to do with that, but it had a little flyer announcing that Dreadstar the Omnibus is coming to Kickstarter.
I know.
Which
I
really...
Can't wait.
The only thing...
The whole series?
Yep.
Well, volume one, at least, which will be 500 pages.
They said it's going to be in two hardcovers, I think.
Oh.
So very...
I think they did some collection before, didn't they?
They did, but it was only the first 10 issues or something like that, or I don't know if they got that far.
So... Very curious. I also wonder, that's one of those series where you're like, I hope the price point is right. There's also a fair chance you might be able to buy the whole series out of the 50-cent bin at a chance too. But I really enjoyed the original Dreadstar. I know the art book talks about a recent revival and some of the other stuff, but I remember the good old days of Dreadstar. I mean, I haven't read that stuff since it came out, but I really did enjoy it.
It made Starlin the guy for me. I mean, I was all John Byrne, you know? And then I read the Metamorphosis Odyssey, and I'm like, okay, and Jim Starlin. Yeah.
But I'm slightly also concerned about the remastered version. Like, I wonder if they're going to talk about what they're going to do. Because some of the recoloring type, as you know, I've remarked upon. Part of it for me is a nostalgia thing. So if they're going to recolor it.
He's being involved in the remastering from what I understand. And the last time they did a reprint of the book, I don't think it looked as good as it could have. So I think the black and white stuff, the early Metamorphosis Odyssey stuff came out all right. But the Dreadstar series stuff, I thought the lines, and I could be wrong, but just from recall, I think some of the lines weren't as heavy as they should have been. So I think some remastering needs to happen.
Okay. I'm just, I get a little, cause sometimes I know, and look, if I was a creator and it was something I did a long time ago, I might want to monkey with it or use some of the new technology. You know what I mean? I get the temptation, but I just don't want it to be too much changed or recolored or anything
that. The whole first part of it should be just black and white. It better not be color, because that's how the Metamorphosis Odyssey and the price originally was.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kidding. But you know what I mean when this remaster.
I do.
Like, it's good to clean up what you have, but a cleanup can turn to fiddling to fix problems and this, that, and the other thing and get you far aground.
On this, you either end up with, like, the IDW... remastering in quotes, or then sometimes you end up with, like, the Marvel Masterwork stuff,
right?
Or then on the far end with the Neil Adams Batman stuff.
Ooh. I'll take the Masterworks with the nice flat colors.
Well, I'm not saying do a DC omnibus where you leave pages out or anything.
Wow,
they had another one, I guess was missing one of the recent Wonder Woman ones was missing a page of text or something.
That's unfortunate.
I like to give the big two a hard time every once in a while.
Back to the Black Book.
Warner Brothers and Disney can afford to take a few shots from an independent podcast.
this...
Yeah, well, why would you cut out, like, all the captions as part of a story in the first page of your story? Like, stuff like that always bugs me. It's like, yeah, you know, you're editorializing your That just bugs me. It's you're altering the story, and you're like, these caption boxes don't need to be in the story anymore. I'm like, wait a second. Like, that's going way beyond any reconstruction or remastering.
On the Black Book front, I think it's cool. They're doing a series of these. They're including one with each of the recent Kickstarters they've done with different creators. I think there's a Rick Leonardi one. There's a Daryl Banks one. There's a Bart Sears one. There's the Starlin one. So I think that's kind of cool that they're coming up with their own line of art of books for creators who are publishing material through Ominous. I think it's also cool that the creators pick the pieces and then they include their own commentary.
And yes, I liked there was some history bits that I was unaware. I also think that they intentionally go out of the way to pick some interesting, like they have some of their famous pieces, but they're going to pick more obscure and interesting. So if you're a super fan, I definitely think it's worth it because you're going to see, I would say I'm a fan, I'm not a super fan, but there was stuff in here that I had either forgotten or didn't know that he had worked on, like some of the Batman stuff.
What my problem was with the Black Book was that it was part of a Kickstarter that was making a hardcover re-release of his, I think it was just a digital book, like a Kindle book that he did, the Hardcore Station stuff, where he did spot illustrations, but it's a prose book. And there was a Kickstarter to make this into a big hardcover, which is cool because Starlin's not drawing anymore. Here's a chance to get some more Starlin art out there. And then one of the side things was, as part of the campaign, was this Black Book that you could get both books. And I did get both books. But the
I did it reverse. I just got the digital of the book and the copy of the art book.
The bummer of it is there's a really large, I mean, maybe a fifth of the Black Book is dedicated to the Hardcore Station art and stuff. So it feels like almost like a cross promotion for the other book. But if you already got them both, to me, it was like a waste of 20 pages because I just got your other big hardcover book, same size, same format. And now, you know, I got it twice. I would have liked to have devoted that real estate to something else that wasn't sitting right next to it on the shelf, you know?
Yeah, that Valiant and Zenoscope will do that in their trades.
You're hating on the Valiant again.
I'm just saying, they rip you off sometimes.
But it sounds like
even indie companies can rip you off. How about that?
Well, it's a fine novel. I just haven't gotten to it, but I was getting this for the art book. I mean, I had the wrong focus, but they clearly set it up. They knew a bunch of us were there for more. And then, like I said, I do have my digital copy. So at some point I'm sure I will get around to reading it, but I wanted to get myself on the little art book, and it had a nice little print that came with it. Although I gotta admit, the packaging was ridiculous. It came in this gigantic box.
Yep.
And clearly they must have ordered like set sizes of boxes, because I was like, what could be in here? And it's an oversized book. It ain't that. It's not an artist edition. Don't get too fired up. But it was nice. I particularly enjoyed the early Thanos, like seeing a young, just out of the military, Jim Starlin kicking around ideas from the very beginning. And his whole intro was about that, how Thanos was his first creation and yet his largest one. Although I would have to say, people really dig Dreadstar. I mean, he's not in a movie or anything, but...
Yet,
exactly.
They tried.
I'd like to see Dreadstar that animated.
Yeah.
If they go. I don't really want to see a live action.
Like heavy metal movie animation. Yeah. That would be so awesome. Because, I mean, it's a crazy story. Dreadstar gets recruited by a wizard. Who they're in the Milky Way galaxy in the future. And the galaxy is being overrun by an invading force of aliens who has done this to galaxy after galaxy and been victorious, and nothing can stop them. So they decide they're going to euthanize the galaxy in order to stop this threat. In order to save it, they have to destroy it. And then they go about their task of destroying the galaxy and then dealing with the fallout from that. And that all happens before the Dreadstar series even starts. So cool.
Yeah, and it's the first appearance of the Badoon. No, only joking.
But that's Sizzky
Marvel, Marvel joke there for the folks at home and love the cheap seats.
The Catman.
To me, it also, as a young man, it spoke to, obviously the cartoon was much simpler, but it did also remind me of Thundar, kind of. He had a guy with a laser sword and, you know, various characters and everything. I felt it was kind of, you know, hey, you know, they have the like monster Chewbacca Ookla type creature that fought that partner in it and everything. So I was like, yeah, it's kind of like a Thundar the Barbarian for adults. Because that show was pretty simple.
But was any character pissing, though, Andrew?
Well, not in the children's cartoon of the, what was that, 19, early 80s, late 70s?
What kind of question is that?
Well, I'm just saying we read Criminal.
That worries me, Kevin.
We read Criminal.
Hey, don't shame Kevin. He's allowed to be into whatever he
maybe
wants.
Maybe it's out of context. I don't know.
And there is a scene in Criminal where a character is pissing, and I'm like, ah, there we go. Indie comics.
I support your lifestyle choices, Kevin. Don't let Phil shame you.
I will shame him.
I bet you Phil's done some pretty crazy shit, so you don't need to be worried.
It happens. You slip, you know.
All right, folks. Are we good? Do we want to keep? That seems like we've been. We're good. Mm-hmm. I'll save some more for next time. I wanted to thank everyone for lending us their ears for this short romp down memory lane. And we hope you'll tune in to our regularly unscheduled program.
That's and helpful.
Super Steve has a sign off, Kevin. Now, do you have your own? You can't really rip off Steve because he's actually on this one. So.
Different indie time, different indie channel. Oof. Different indie schedule.
All right, Phil, any catchphrase?
You know I don't have one.
May the good books be yours.
I will never have one.
All right, well.
Don't take any wooden nickels.
Thanks for listening.
Don't forget to bag and board your comics.
Oh, Steve, you're not going to give us a later?
Later.
Oh, yeah. That's right. What are you doing?
Leonardo leads, Donatello does machines. That's a fact, Jack.